All right, I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:22 p.m. on Wednesday, May 12th, 2021. Members present are Representatives McCarty, Nelson, Vice Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Fields, and myself, Rep. Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Thanks for our secretary today, Leah Fraser, and our LAO moderator, Alex Banaszek, for joining us this afternoon here in the room. Reminder to members to use your microphone for those that are listening online, as well as for our House record staff. If you haven't already, it's a good time to silence your cell phone. We've got three items on our agenda: a third hearing of HB 159, the governor's bill on data privacy, an introductory hearing for HB 58 relating to insurance coverage for contraception, and a third hearing for HB 44 related to certified public accountants. Are there any questions before we begin? All right, that brings us to our third hearing on HB 159, the governor's bill on consumer data privacy. Online for invited testimony, we will hear from Ashkan Soltani, fellow at the Georgetown Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy, co-author of the CCPA and the CPRA, and former chief technologist at the Federal Trade Commission. Welcome, Representative Snyder, who has joined us at 3:23 p.m. Online to finish the presentation of the sectionals, the Assistant Attorney General John Haley, and also available for questions from the Department of Law's Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills. All right, first up, we're going to go to Ms. Soltani. Are you there, Ms. Soltani?
Hello.
Oh.
Hello there.
Mr. Soltani, I apologize.
That's okay. Thank you. Thank you all for having me. Hopefully you can hear me okay?
Sure can.
Great. So I appreciate the invitation. Thank you. And it's wonderful that you guys are taking on such an important topic. You have the virtue of the strong privacy protections in the Alaska Constitution, so I'm really excited to see your work. Thank you for the generous introduction as well. I have over something like 20 years experience in privacy and security. My core work presently is working on privacy enforcement. For example, with the Georgetown Center, we support and expand the capability of state AGs in their enforcement work. As you said, I was with one of the co-authors of CCPA and CPRA, and also the co-creator of the Global Privacy Control Standard, the technical standard, which I'll talk about in a second. I was also one of the originators of Do Not Track technical standard, which is what the Global Privacy Control is built on. Briefly, just a history of CCPA. If folks probably know most of this, but just a quick recap. CCPA was introduced as a ballot initiative in California, originally as a ballot initiative. It included, for example, instantiation, a private right of action, and was initially thought of as a global opt-in framework. Over time, the proponent, switched to an opt-out framework with the global privacy control, which I'll talk about in a second, and then removed the private right of action as well as a couple other tweaks in order to pass it as a legislative bill in 2018, as legislation in 2018. From 2018 to 2020, the industry spent, ad tech primarily, but a lot of industry spent something like 2 years lobbying and introducing amendments to weaken it, including very small definitional tweaks that would have completely gutted the core function of the bill, for example, in definitions of who is a service provider, who is a first party, et cetera. Proponent then introduced Prop 24, another ballot initiative, which included a number of tweaks and fixes to CCPA based on both what we were experiencing in Sacramento in lobbying, as well as what we understood from industry as workarounds or problems with the law. The key provision in the CPRA that I think people would be interested in, two key provisions, are that any future amendments to the CPRA can fix issues with the law, but they cannot substantially go against the purpose and intent of the law. And we have some precedent in California Constitution that says that essentially amendments need to be more pro-privacy. They can't kind of weaken the law significantly. And then two, the creation of kind of a consumer privacy protection agency, a DPA, so to speak, to help with enforcement, as the state AG is limited in their ability to enforce. And I can talk a little bit about my experience at FTC and with working with state AGs about the capacity and the ability to enforce such a kind of broad-ranging issue. Briefly, and so Prop 24 passed with something like 9 million votes in 2020. It goes into effect in 2023. Passed in 2021, goes into effect in 2023. We can talk about some of the fixes. I did see that a number of the fixes and tweaks in CPRA were included in HB 159, so I thought that was positive, very positive. I think HB 159 is one of the best implementations or instantiations I've seen of the various state bills, and it includes all the fixes and tweaks, or many of them at least. There are some small suggestions I might have on fixes, and I'm happy to answer any questions, but that was a positive development. I will say I've also participated in a number of industry events, including I keynoted an event a few, maybe 2 months ago now, and it was I asked to stay on for the Chatham House kind of discussions, and where I think industry very openly presented their approach to deal with the CPRA, which is to introduce weaker bills in other states, like they have in Virginia, in order to bring down the standard, as well as provide differences or push bills in differing states to justify federal preemption using a weaker standard. So it's an active industry kind of strategy to try to push privacy laws that are weaker. And I did see some industry letters to your committee arguing to, for example, opt for the Virginia flavor of the privacy laws, which I'm glad you have not chosen to do, particularly because, you know, in many industry events, their chief lobbyists and others have argued that it was a win for industry to pass that law, and it has some key limitations, which fortunately your bill does not. For starters, I was impressed that HB 159 includes, for example, the definitions around pseudonymous identifiers. This is essentially the fact that personal information is not defined just as information that directly identifies you by name, but it does include information like device identifiers or cookies or other pseudonymous, essentially, tokens that represent your identity without referring to you by name. And that's primarily the way the ad tech industry has worked and the data broker industry has worked for decades. And so it's important that that's included. I was also happy to see the inclusion of an authorized agent, particularly because, as we know, the behavior of consumers are such that they often, particularly when it's challenging or particularly when it's an issue that they're not visibly aware of, but in fact it happens behind the scenes, like so many of the privacy violations, that they can enlist an authorized agent that they could either hire or pay, or if it's a nonprofit, that can help invoke their rights. So I think that's an important development. And one nice additional touch that I saw that 159 has is the ability to know which specific third parties your data was sold to. That's something that the CCPA, the initial CCPA ballot initiative had, but it was one of the compromises that was taken out. And I think it's important to have that piece, particularly because it allows consumers to know who their data was sold to, so that they can then follow up and request that information be deleted or opt out of the sale of those downstream providers. So I thought that was wonderful. Some small tweaks that I would suggest. One, as I said, is I think it's important to include. I'm one of the creators of this global privacy control, and what that is essentially a technical standard for a browser setting, or essentially a control in your browser that lets consumers invoke their opt-out rights. So rather than click on every website that they visit, rather than click on an opt-out link on every website they visit, they can set a setting in their browser, and essentially that setting communicates their opt-out preference to the businesses that they interact with. Mm-hmm. And so we've created that standard. It's based on Do Not Track, which, if you're familiar, is another technical standard. And right now, for example, some 40 million consumers use a browser or tool that has a global privacy control, so Brave, DuckDuckGo, a few others. Mm-hmm. And then a number of major publishers like the Washington Post, the New York Times, WordPress, others honor that signal as a valid opt-out, mm-hmm. which means that consumers that use Brave and go to the New York Times, they're automatically opted out of the sale of their information. They don't need to go and click a bunch of buttons and find links and stuff. So I think that's an important development. This is similar to, for example, if you have an iPhone and you've seen those kind of the tracking technology pop-ups. There's also a global setting on the iPhone that says, don't let companies ask me to be tracked. It's kind of conceptually similar to allow kind of one setting for consumers to opt out of the sale of their personal information. And the California AG has recognized this as a valid standard and has indicated they're going to begin enforcing companies that don't honor the standard. So I think that's an important piece to add because it significantly improves consumers' abilities to invoke their right and without having to go and find links on every website and opt out, which we know they won't do. The other thing that I thought wasn't included from CPRA, but you might consider, is the definition of sale. So as you might have seen, the CPRA switched from sale to sale or sharing. And this is because even though sale in the CCPA was defined for any sharing of data for valuable consideration, for monetary or valuable consideration, we learned over time that industry was arranging contracts where they would share personal information and indicate in the contract that it was not for valuable consideration. And so while some might say that's too clever by half, there was a concern that a lot of the sharing that is a tit-for-tat sharing in order, for example, a website to share with another advertiser in order to reduce the cost of ads, essentially to improve the efficiency of ads and reduce the cost of ads, that would fall outside of the definition of sale. So we'd change it to sale or share. The other piece that was a little bit confusing for me is this idea of verified user requests. So in the CCPA and CPRA, we said that while you do need a verified user request to do things like delete or access data for privacy reasons and for, you know, you don't want someone deleting your kids' photos, you shouldn't need to verify a request to opt out of sale or even potentially opt out of the use of your location information, right? So oftentimes when you visit a website, as I said, you're pseudonymous, you've not identified who you are, you're just device 1234. But they have your precise geolocation and they know your activity over time of what other websites you visited and what other locations you might have been. You should be able to request essentially that you can opt out of the sale of that information without having to then say your full name and social security number and whatever else. So I think that's an important thing to get right. There's also one additional piece we added in the CCPA that I think is critical, which is that says any information collected from the consumer for the purpose of, say, opting out of sale or invoking their rights can't be used for another purpose, right? And this is critical. As you know, for example, all of you are familiar with spam, sadly. When you click an opt-out link at the bottom of your spam message, right, what ends up happening is under canned spam, that company is required to opt you out of receiving spam from that entity. But what you've just done by clicking that opt-out link is verify to the company that their messages are getting through and that you're a live person. Mm-hmm. So they then go on and sell that list to another data broker, which then generates more spam, which then repeats the cycle. And so it's critical that opt-outs don't need to essentially, information collected for an opt-out or a verified consumer request can't be used for any other purpose. So I think that's another piece, small tweak, that I think was important. And then lastly, I think, while the CCPA and CPRA doesn't include it, I would consider whether to include nonprofits, right? So in my experience, and I've actually, you know, spoken publicly about this, I was hired, for example, by the ACLU to perform an audit of their privacy practices, and I've worked with other nonprofits as well. Nonprofits, sadly, in this current day and age, engage in the same data sale and data sharing practices as many businesses, right? They use Facebook, they use Google Ads, they use all these for the purpose of fundraising and others. And much of that sharing would constitute a sale under the definitions of CCPA or the HB 159. But unfortunately, there is no oversight of nonprofits' use of personal information, neither at the state level nor the federal level, right? The FTC doesn't capture nonprofits. So that's a huge gap that I hope other states consider taking up. And then I think ultimately the biggest question or challenge is going to be enforcement, right? As I said, I've worked with the Federal Trade Commission. I personally worked on the 2011 Facebook case, the 2010 Google case. I work with a number of state AGs on these cases. And when you think about capacity, right, oftentimes, like the California AG has said, that they only have their staff of, I think, something like 10 privacy folks and in that agency have the ability to do two or three cases per year, right? And so as you think about the effectiveness of this law and whether it can effectively be enforced. I think it's important to consider whether the AG or the enforcement agency has the ability to enforce, or whether there needs to be a private right of action, or whether there's a hybrid where the AG can partner with plaintiff firms or, you know, with nonprofits and others to enforce the law, right? One of the other key things in the CPRA is, in addition to creating the Data Protection Agency, it creates a fund by which fees and fines from enforcement of the CPRA go into a state fund, but then goes into a consumer protection fund that the agency can pull from. And I think that model is important as you think about effective enforcement, having real teeth on this thing. Otherwise, as we've seen with other state laws, companies will just ignore them, or it's just a compliance check mark on their, you know, they feel like they won't get caught.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Ashkan? All right. Commissioner Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Sultani, for your testimony. You know, the enforcement item you mentioned seems key to me. We don't have the resident expertise in tech privacy within our Attorney General office right now in terms of doing enforcement. So one thing I've been thinking about is what's the right fee-based structure for companies that are going to be affected by this law. How do we collect an adequate amount of fees to fund enforcement within the AG? So I'd appreciate your input on, you know, how do we put that into law to collect an adequate amount of revenue to sustainably fund an adequately sized cadre of AGs who will make sure this law is being followed. So I don't know if you have the answer offhand, but, you know, in looking through changes that I would like to see in this bill, that one to me is the hardest to conceptualize, because I don't know if it's a fee per user, if it's, you know, per dollar of revenue. Your guidance on that would be appreciated. I don't want to have it so general and be left to the administration and that trigger yet another round of lobbying by companies to dilute it. I want to have it strong in the legislation. That would just be my personal goal. So thank you for your guidance on that.
No, absolutely. And I think that's a critical piece of both the staff and the technical expertise. Right? One of the challenges, I helped create the Office of Technology or Research Investigation at the FTC, and this is to bring technical expertise to the agency. And one of the challenges are the people available to do this work will receive something like 3 or 4 times the salary that a government agency can pay them, right? So not only the number of people, but being able to draw experts or have the access to experts, I think is critical. And so I do think figuring out a fee structure, there is a couple models, right? One is, I would say, a percentage of the revenue the company receives directly from the sale of personal information. I think that's probably the most cleanly associated to this bill, right? One of the challenges, however, is a lot of the value is non-monetary, right? So as I said, if a publisher, for example, includes personal information in their ad calls and in their requests for advertisement, what they're getting is essentially an increased, increased revenue from the ads because of a decreased or increased efficiency. Like, it effectively, the ad, the personal information goes to the ad targeting, but isn't a direct monetary payment in the standard sense. So it's hard to capture. The other model, as you might consider, is kind of an eat what you kill model. So like the Secret Service, most people don't know, Secret Service, in addition to protecting the president, they often are tasked with enforcement of financial crimes and credit card laundering, counterfeit money, et cetera. And they have an eat what you kill model, which is the revenue they bring in, they use to then build up staff and help, help build out their capacity to go after other bad actors. So there's probably something in the middle of those two that you could consider. I personally think Alaska has done a great job in kind of helping to demonstrate that this resource, you know, in other environments where resources are extracted from Alaska, having some tax paid on those resources to then benefit the citizens of Alaska. I think that model works well in this space too, which is companies, you know, either a fee based on their the percentage of sale, as I said, or perhaps the general revenue of a company that falls under, for example, your data broker classification, right? So you define companies as data brokers in a very narrow way. And so you could say those companies have to pay a percentage. And that's not unlike what Maryland has considered in their digital tax law that they're proposing.
All right, and I just want to note Representative Kaufman joined us at 3:24, just a couple of minutes after Mr. Soltani started his testimony.
So. Thank you.
All right, anybody else?
If there aren't further questions, I have a separate line of questions.
All right, question another from question. Mr. Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. So you talked about the global privacy control and that of someone could go onto a setting on the browser to do that. Are there some, this is what I wrote down, what features does someone give up when they establish that? So does the, do companies then deny them access to explore, you know, or whatever, when they give that up?
Kind of so, like the, yeah, so the way to think of the global privacy control is it's just the signal that is transmitted from the browser to the business that the consumer intends to interact with. It's the easiest way to think about it is it's as if the consumer found the do not sell button and clicked it, right? And so, you know, currently the laws require that companies provide a do not sell link or button. The global privacy control effectively clicks that button, right? And so now the question is what happens after that button is clicked, separate from the global privacy control. And I believe the HB 159 permits companies to charge consumers a different rate or service, right, as long as it's not usurious and whatnot, directly related to the sale of that personal information. That would still be possible when a business encounters a global privacy control. They could say, we've noticed you would like to opt out of the sale of your personal information. Would you like to, you know, either disable that for our site and permit us to opt in, or would you like to pay a fee, or whatever else the law permits when a consumer opts out. So just to be clear, the GPC isn't a separate thing. It's literally, if you had a little robot on your computer that clicked the do not sell link for you on every site you went to, that's effectively all that it is. And the consumer can say, no, for you, you know, New York Times, I'm okay selling my information if the New York Times shows them a pop-up. Fortunately, what we found, most sites right now that honor the GPC just honor it without any interstitial or any kind of pop up to the user. The key thing to realize is that while the current ecosystem of the data supported ad economy exists very much on the sale of personal information, there are new innovative features and technologies that are attempting to serve advertising without necessarily using personal information in the same way, right? And so there's been a lot of development in not only contextual ads, which are just ads based on the page the consumer visits. So I can go to a website and read an article about cars without necessarily the company revealing anything about me, but just saying we have a, you know, we can show ads about cars on the car page because we know the people that would probably read that are interested in cars. So that is a non-privacy invasive way companies can sell advertisement and not use personal information. There are some other evolutions in terms of how kind of more sustainable advertising is being done, where companies will honor an opt-out and then basically explore alternative ways to advertise. And even some of the big players like Google and others are trying to innovate ways on essentially sustainable advertising in the way we have sustainable energy.
Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just the follow-up was that if I opt that out and then my settings that I'm now looking at this business, they have their catalog of things. They saw that I opted out, so their prices are more expensive for me because I opted out compared to you. Let's say you didn't opt out. Is that something that exists or consideration?
The law, yeah, the law permits that, right? The law in California and I believe HB 159 says that a company can essentially charge a person for that wishes to invoke their rights, essentially a fee that is not usurious or exploitative, but is directly related to the sale of their personal information, right? And so separate from the global opt-out setting, right now, if I go to a website in California as a California consumer, and that website makes 100% of their revenue from the sale of personal information, right? if I click the opt-out, that website can say, we essentially generate about $2 per user from the sale of your information. So if you'd like to opt out of the sale, you should pay $2, right? That's what the law permits. There's a couple key provisions, which, such as say, the companies have to calculate that average cost on a per user basis and articulate that to the AG in order to do that charge. But that right exists. We fortunately haven't seen a lot of that because, as I said, rather than charging consumers, a lot of sites are saying, let's explore different models. They're saying, please either opt in, right? For us, please allow us to sell your personal information. Or if not, we will explore other models. And that might be a subscription service. You might have to sign up to pay, or we might charge you just for viewing this one page or content.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Victor Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Soltani. Question on protection of children's information. You see in HB 159 some guidelines. What's sort of the best practice for protecting kids' information? To me, that's one of the most disturbing things about the sale of personal information today.
Absolutely. I think the opt-in requirement is critical. One thing to think about is the current standard in HB 159 is a direct knowledge standard. And one thing to think about is, for example, the FTC YouTube case, which essentially argues a more of an expected standard that essentially if you have a website that has cartoons and is only kind of kids content and it's bright colors and all these other attributes, but you don't know the age of your kids, maybe you still have a kid's site and maybe you have a higher standard. And so I know Common Sense Media is very active in this space. I don't know if you have engaged with them, but they're useful on this, and they were supportive of the CCPA and CPRA. But I would look at some of the ways this direct knowledge standard is evolving, right, to maybe a more negligent standard that was presented in the Google YouTube case. And I think that's critical as we see things like, folks might have seen Facebook is planning to do an Instagram Kids, right? And so that's going to be very much a kid-directed website or service. But effectively, my suspicion is, as what happened with YouTube, is that a lot of the content that is generated on Instagram Kids will also be available on Instagram. And you might find kids accessing that same content on Instagram, right, on Instagram channels, for example. And then Facebook could argue that, well, we didn't know that was for kids, even though the people looking at this were exclusively, children, likely children because of the nature of the content. And so that's something that I think is worth exploring because it's evolving, right? We know that it doesn't necessarily need to be the child directed to be, exclusively child directed to have child directed content.
Hello?
Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. Soltani? All right. This is very interesting. Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Snyder has a question.
And this may be more a question for the chairs, and forgive me if I missed it hopping from one committee to the next. Do we have a written summary or resource pertaining to some of the recommendations or categories that we just addressed today?
You know, we don't, but maybe we could ask Mr. Soltani to send an email to the co-chairs with his recommendations. I think that'd be really useful.
Sure, I can submit written testimony for sure.
That'd be really helpful.
Yeah, happy to do that.
All right, Co-Chair Fields.
In addition, my staff has been keeping track of all the recommendations from Mr. Soltani, the previous experts who we heard from, and the businesses that have weighed in as we work on drafting a CS that will both protect Alaska businesses from unnecessary regulation, but also make sure we have adequate oversight over these outside tech companies that are selling data. So you will see all those embodied in a CS request that I hope to get in shortly.
I think, if I may add, I think that's absolutely critical to document. One of the challenges, as I said, is that after the passage of CCPA and CPRA, industry has taken a position that they have 50 other tries at this apple, right? And they're trying in 50 states to find ways around the bar that at least California set. And because this stuff is so technically nuanced, where literally one of the amendments to CCPA was a 7-word amendment that would have completely gutted the function of the law for large advertising companies that I just mentioned, right? It's important to document and kind of have technical expertise on what those keywords and changes are. So I think it's wonderful that you're doing that, and always happy to be a service, as there are a number of experts that you can consult, but I'm always happy to help as well.
And my intent, assuming the committee is interested, would be to bring that CS and then work through it with some of the experts you've heard from to explain the changes that we've made and why we made each of those.
All right. Other questions? All right. With that, thank you very much, Mr. Sultani. Next, we're going to go back to the sectional analysis with Assistant Attorney General John Haley and AG Hanley. We are going to continue the sectional analysis till 4:05. So we're not going to get through it. I apologize. But it's a big bill. We'll have more opportunities to do this. We're not going to rush this process. But if you could pick up where you left out, could you remind the committee which section we stopped at, and then we'll pick up from there?
Sure. For the record, this is John Haley, Assistant Attorney General from the Alaska Department of Law. We left off at the start of Article 2, which is AS 45.49.100, retaliation prohibited. So that's where we'll be starting today. And I'll take it from there.
All right. One moment. Representative Snyder has a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I apologize. We apparently went over this originally. Could someone please refresh my memory with the section 45.49.015? Who would this person be that's being referenced?
We're on page 3, line 21. 45.49.015.
Yes, that's okay. Correct. Line 22, when a person receives. I'm just trying to envision who that person would be.
Okay. Through the chair, you cut out a few times there, but I think the question was who is a person in AS 45.49.015? And the answer to that is, you know, a person is essentially anyone. A business is defined very specifically, but a person would be any corporation or any natural person. So businesses that don't qualify under our definition of business that we've gone over would still be persons for the purposes of 0.015.
You have a follow-up?
Yeah, I was just making sure, like, if something with information landed in my mailbox, am I beholden to reporting the receipt of this? But it sounds like we're just trying to expand the definition beyond business to any other entity, such as a corporation. I'm just trying to understand an actual scenario.
Through the chair, you know, that's an interesting question. I have to say I haven't thought about the situation where a business would disclose another person's personal information to you and how that would apply. I haven't really thought that through, to be honest. I think the main intent was to talk about a business sharing information with another corporation that wouldn't normally meet the definition of business. And the idea was that if you as a consumer give your information to one company, a social media company, for instance, and they share it with other companies who share it with other companies, that you should be able to figure out who all of those companies are by just making one request to that initial collector. You know, whether or not there's going to be some problem with your personal information being shared not only with smaller corporations or other corporations that wouldn't meet the definition of business, but also with you know, individual humans, and that this is going to impose some burden on them. I guess I'd have to think more about that.
Thank you.
All right. And then for the purposes of the sectional, if you can refresh us on the page and line number, since the sections are long.
I understand. Sure. And let me just scroll back up. So we are on page 15, line 2.
All right, page 15, line 2. Article 2, activities and penalties relating to personal information, yeah?
To the chair, yes, that's correct.
All right. Let's proceed, Mr. Haley.
Okay. So the first section we're dealing with here is AS45.49.100, retaliation prohibited. And this section says that if a business can't retaliate against a consumer in response to that consumer exercising their rights under this chapter. So, for instance, if you as a consumer issued a disclosure request or a deletion request, the business wouldn't be allowed, as a general rule, to deny you goods or services or charge you different prices or impose penalties or start giving you a worse service or things like that. However, B of this section says that notwithstanding what I've just talked about, a business can charge a consumer a different rate or provide a different level of services to the consumer if that difference is reasonably related to the value provided to the business by the consumer's data. So a business could potentially have a free service, as I think the last speaker talked about, and a $2 service if the value of your data is $2, and that's something that they've been able to determine and can defend that number. A business could also offer a financial incentive for a consumer to allow the collection, sale, retention of their data, all those kinds of things, or provide some kind of incentive program with a better service, same sort of concept there, as long as they notify the consumer of what's going on, what the financial incentives are, and they're not doing anything that's unjust, unreasonable, or coercive. Are there any questions on that section?
Actually, I have a question. So I'm looking at lines 7 and 8, which essentially says that retaliation that's prohibited includes charging different prices or rates for goods and services, including through the use of discounts and other benefits or imposing penalties. And then notwithstanding, down on lines 13 through 16, it says a business may charge a consumer a different rate or provide different level of quality or services, yada, yada, yada. These two provisions seem to be in conflict with one another.
To the chair, I wouldn't necessarily disagree that this couldn't be written more clearly, but I think the intent here is that we're providing a general rule in A of the section, and then in B, when we say notwithstanding, there's a condition placed on that, and the condition is that the difference has to be reasonably related to the value provided. Perhaps it could be written better, but that's the concept I think that's laid out.
All right, thank you. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, yes, I wonder, is the problem in the writing, or is it in just the pure difficulty of the concept to say that it has to be equal, but then it can be different? That just seems like a stiff challenge. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I guess I would say that certainly writing bills in this area is always a challenge. I think it's technical, it's complicated, it's long, there is some difficulty. Perhaps it would be difficult to find better language, but I guess I'd just say that is the intent, to provide the general rule that you can't retaliate, and then say notwithstanding that rule, charge a different rate or provide a different level of services if what you're doing is reasonably related to the value of the data, and you can, defend that decision. You can defend the value that you've placed on that data. So I guess that's the concept. Perhaps it would be difficult to write it in a better way.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Schrage.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. And I'm curious if there's a reason that denying a good or service isn't allowed under B of this section as well, if the business model for whatever business it might be relied on collecting that personal information for them to deliver that service.
Through the chair, Representative, I think that's an interesting question. I think that, what this section does is it attempts to make, to create a scenario where consumers are always going to be able to have at least some ability to access, the various services, the various social media companies, et cetera, without having to give up essentially all of their privacy rights. And if denying a service was allowed there under B, it just wouldn't fit well into the concept, I guess, first of all, because it's, you can't provide a different rate or a different quality of service if you're denying it. But just allowing the denial of the service altogether, I guess, would create a situation at least where some users would be stuck in a difficult position, perhaps with large companies that they've been with for many years, Google or Facebook or YouTube or whoever that may be, and other companies as well, would be faced with very difficult choices, and perhaps it would be ideal to give consumers the ability to have a choice to either pay money or have a different service, but still be able to be a part of this ecosystem that's been around for a long time. But as a matter of policy, whether it would be better to allow businesses to simply cut off consumers who refuse to allow them to sell their data, for instance, that's an interesting question of policy that that could be considered further.
You could see a situation as well where a business might decide that they didn't, in order to force the acceptance of data sharing, that they would refuse to provide services to people that didn't want to have their data shared, and that could be, a form of sort of exclusion from basic app access. For example, if Facebook said, if you don't allow us to have access to your contacts in your phone, you may not participate in Facebook, and then they would be excluded from the marketplace of ideas. And now Facebook is our town square now. The town square is in the town square. Facebook is the town square, and so that could be a little bit problematic. Representative Shragi?
And I agree that this is a very challenging issue, and I think that's part of my just difficulty with this entire concept, that it seems it would be much better managed on a federal level, because at that point we're talking about Facebook as a common marketplace and, something that almost should be regulated like a utility if it's really that embedded into the fabric of society. Is it a private business that has the ability to exclude access or set requirements on its services, or is it a common piece of infrastructure to society that should be regulated on a federal level? I don't know the answer to that. And a lot of difficulties in this bill.
Good question. All right, next up we've got Co-Chair Fields and then Representative Coffin.
Yeah, I was going to comment on Representative Shragi's point. The problem with denial of services, you do have a situation like, Facebook won't let you access Facebook in your phone unless they sell all your private information, including your cell phone contacts. Very pernicious. It was also a problem with the GDPR where, you opt in, and as soon as you opt in, it basically voids the entire law. So I think we have to avoid that. Avoid that problem. And I would also like to see functional federal regulation and legislation, but the reality is we're not going to have it. Congress is broken, so I think we have no choice but to do it in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Representative Coffin?
Thank you. With respect to the earlier comment about being the public, the virtual public square, there's many of these services that arbitrarily ban people based upon, the political persuasion of their speech, too. So, such as Twitter. It's becoming notorious for that. All of this has caused me to wonder if maybe the bill, as much as I want something like this, because I do have great concerns, if something that operates at a higher level with principles, more like a consumer bill of rights type approach, and that may be a subject for our prior speaker, Mr. Sultani, but I'm just thinking that perhaps by trying to define so closely, we're running into traps that can never be reconciled with the current structure. Thank you.
And the challenge, Representative Coffman, with broader principles is that there would be probably endless litigation about what those broader principles meant. So you're describing some of the very, quandaries that we find ourselves in as a legislature, and we are coming up on our time. I'm going to give us 4 more minutes on this topic so that Mr. Haley can continue forward a little bit further.
Thank you. So the next section is AS45.49.110, transfer of information in a merger or acquisition. And what this section does is it says that a business can transfer personal information to a third party as part of a merger or acquisition of that business. However, if the new owner of that personal information, the acquirer, I guess if you will, wants to change any of the policies that previously existed for using or sharing that information, the new owner would have to notify consumers before making such a change and ensure that the consumers can exercise their rights under this chapter. And if there are questions on that, I'll answer them, or if not, I'll move on to .120.
Go ahead. Continue.
So the next section is 45.49.120. This is a duty to maintain reasonable security measures, and this section requires that businesses that own, license, or maintain personal information must implement and maintain reasonable security measures to protect information from unauthorized access, destruction, use, modification, or disclosure.
Representative Schrocki has a question.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So, I mean, reasonable is a very kind of, we talked just a second ago about broad principles and some of the challenges that exist therein. I mean, I'm just wondering if there's some sort of advocacy group or nonprofit or something that has maybe kind of set some privacy protection standards or encryption or authentication standards, or if there's something that we could refer to that would maybe put a finer point on this, or maybe just get your thoughts on what reasonable is defined as from the Department of Law's perspective. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative, there certainly are some concepts out there about how best to protect personal information. You know, two-step authentication, for instance, is a concept, and perhaps we could get in touch with you regarding some of the various concepts that are out there. But I do think it's true that reasonable is something that to some degree has a bit of vagueness, but reasonable is a pretty common standard in the law, and it's necessary because things do change over time. Two-step authentication is becoming pretty standard in a lot of situations because of the way that, for instance, scammers have, you know, developed their techniques over time. And I think that as technology changes, as you know, hackers change their methods, what becomes reasonable changes. I think that what's reasonable may also depend to some degree on the size of the business and their capabilities. I think we may be able to further define this by regulation and to change it over time, but I guess those are my comments for now.
Thank you. I wonder if the FTC or any other federal organizations have put any definitions around that or standards around that, but no need for follow-up since we're limited on time. Thank you.
All right, we'll give you one more section.
The last section is AS 45.49.130. This is the violation section, and it says, this is a somewhat complicated section, it says that the violation of this chapter is a violation of the Unfair Trade Practices Act, which starts at AS 45.50.471. The Unfair Trade Practices Act is a law that's largely based off of the FTC Act, but it generally outlaws unfair and deceptive trade practices, and it houses a number of other acts similar to this one that involve consumer protection type things, parts of Automotor Dealer Act, the Charitable Solicitations Act, other things like that. A violation of the Unfair Trade Practices Act subjects a person, if the Attorney General brings a lawsuit, to civil penalties of $1,000 to $25,000 per violation, and the Attorney General can also seek injunctive relief in an Unfair Trade Practices Act. So the AG has the enforcement power through the Unfair Trade Practices Act to go after violations of this act. The Unfair Trade Practices Act also establishes investigative powers, the ability to issue investigative subpoenas to compel testimony or documents, those sorts of things. So it's sort of a general Consumer Protection Act that establishes penalties and investigative powers, and then there are a number of other acts that are kind of housed underneath it. And that's sort of the model that's been created here. So I guess that's sort of the first thing to say about point 130. There are also private rights of action under the Unfair Trade Practices Act. So just an individual, you know, any normal person who is harmed by an unfair trade practices can bring an Unfair Trade Practices Act claim against the person who's harmed them. So if a consumer suffers damages from a violation of this act, that consumer would be able to bring a private right of action and seek treble damages or statutory damages of $500, whichever is greater. One thing about this to note, though, as I talk again, sort of going back to the Unfair Trade Practices Act, to bring that claim, the individual consumer would have to be able to show an ascertainable loss of money or property. That's one of the requirements for an individual to bring an Unfair Trade Practices Act claim. And I think in some instances, many instances, a consumer whose, you know, sort of rights have been violated when a company violates this law may not be able to show an ascertainable loss of money or property. For instance, if a business refuses to respond to your disclosure request, there may not be an ascertainable loss of money or property, and thus you wouldn't be able to bring this case for treble damages. So that's sort of a limitation that's kind of built in. Even though we've created a private right of action, the individual consumer wouldn't necessarily have a recourse unless they can show a loss of money or property. The one exception, however, that we've built in is essentially an exception for data breaches, for the failure to maintain reasonable security measures. So what B of this section says on line 16 is that in an action brought under AS45.50.531, and that's the Private Person Unfair Trade Practices Act claim, a consumer whose information is subjected to unauthorized access, destruction, use, modification, or disclosure has suffered an ascertainable loss of $1 or an amount proven at trial. So we've essentially created a automatic $1 loss, which would be able to get people into court for those data breach cases where a company has violated their duty under point 120 that we just discussed to maintain reasonable security measures.
All right, and I think we are going to have to leave it there. We have gone a little bit over time, and we have two bills further to consider. I want to thank you for your time. I apologize. We were not able to get to everybody's questions. This is a very meaty topic. We will pick this up at a future hearing. Thank you very much for your testimony today, Assistant Attorney General Haley. We appreciate it. All right, that brings us to our next order of business today. It's HB 58, relating to insurance coverage for contraception. Last Friday, we heard public testimony on the bill, but we didn't hear from the bill's sponsor or staff, so we'd like to hear from them today. We also have available for questions in the room Lori Wing-Heyer, the Director of the Division of Insurance, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and Renee Gayhart, Director of the Division of Healthcare Services, the Department of Health and Social Services. Representative Klayman, you want to go ahead and put yourself on the record and proceed with introducing your legislation?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman, and I'm State Representative for House District 21 in West Anchorage. And first, I want to thank you all for hearing House Bill 158. Since the 1990s, 28 states have required health insurance plans regulated by the state to provide coverage of prescription drugs and devices to cover prescription contraceptives. Federal law, under a provision of the Affordable Care Act of 2010, expanded all these state policies in several ways. The ACA's contraceptive coverage guarantee stems from Section 2713 of the Public Health Service Act, which requires non-grandfathered health insurance coverage and employer-sponsored group health plans to cover preventive services without cost sharing. Section 2713 requires coverage of women's preventive services as defined by the Health Resources and Services Administration. The HRSA asked the then Institute of Medicine to recommend that the women's preventive services that should be covered. Based on this recommendation, HRSA defined women's preventive services to include all contraceptives approved by the FDA, sterilization procedures, and patient education and counseling for women of reproductive capacity as prescribed by a healthcare provider, collectively referred to as contraceptive services. The final preventive services rules issued required insurers and group health plans to cover all such contraceptive services. Recognizing that some religions object to contraceptive coverage, however, the federal government issued rules that excluded religious employers from the contraceptive coverage guarantee. More recently, some states have amended and expanded their own requirements to match the federal guarantee. Some of these new state provisions go beyond the federal guarantee. For example, some states have ensured that women may receive an extended supply of a method at one time, usually a 12-month supply rather than a typical 1 or 3 month supply. House Bill 58 puts into Alaska statutes language that is consistent with the standards set in the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee. It also mandates coverage for dispensing up to 12 months of prescription contraceptives at a time. Alaskans often face numerous challenges when trying to access prescription contraceptives. We've heard from women, especially in rural areas, that multiple trips a year to the pharmacy can be an insurmountable barrier in accessing consistent contraception, and that a one-year supply would assist many women in balancing their health, personal health with work and family life. Research featured in the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology article in your bill packet shows that women who are dispensed a 12-month supply of contraceptives have a 30% drop in unplanned pregnancy and a 46% drop in the likelihood of abortion than women dispensed a 1 to 3 month supply. House Bill 58 also saves money for the state. In reviewing the prior version of this legislation my office sponsored in a previous legislative session, the Department of Health and Social Services fiscal note estimated a $1.35 million savings annually due to a reduction in unplanned pregnancies. The women in my family support House Bill 58, and that tells me a lot. They support it not only because it is often time-consuming and inconvenient to obtain a prescription contraceptive every 3 months, or in some cases every month, but they all support it because they know that improved access to contraceptives means improved health for women and families. House Bill 58 also has an additional benefit. It helps protect victims of domestic violence. Over the past few years, there has been an increased awareness in Alaska and on the national level of the issue of domestic violence and sexual assault. Movements such as Me Too and Time's Up have shown that we need to do more as a society to support those that have experienced and are currently experiencing this type of violence. We've learned about the issue of reproductive coercion, also known as contraceptive coercion, a form of domestic or interpersonal violence used by abusers. The Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault advocates and those that have experienced this type of coercion explain and shared stories about contraceptive coercion in which abusers dictate when and how contraceptives can and cannot be accessed as a means of gaining power and control. Research from a 2011 National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey shows that around 9% of U.S. women reported having an intimate partner who tried to get them pregnant when they did not want to or refused to use a condom. This regard for women's health and autonomy is inexcusable. By providing consumers a 12-month supply of birth control methods, including long-acting reversible contraception, House Bill 58 critically supports victims and survivors by assisting those who are attempting to live as safely as possible in the short term while they work toward longer-term safety. Supported by a strong, long-standing body of evidence, contraceptive services have long been recognized by both government bodies and a wide range of private sector experts as a vital and effective component of preventive and public health care. Contraceptive use helps women avoid unintended pregnancy and improve birth spacing, which in turn have substantial positive consequences for infants, women, families, and society. Moreover, although cost can be a daunting barrier to effective contraceptive use on the part of individual women, the evidence strongly suggests that insurance coverage of contraceptive services and supplies without cost sharing is a low-cost or even cost-saving means of helping women overcome this obstacle. House Bill 58 makes sense for Alaskan women and families, and with that, I will turn it over to my staff, Lizzie Kubitz, to explain the details of the bill.
All right, Ms. Kubitz, can you walk us through a brief sectional analysis?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lizzie Kubitz, and I'm staff to Representative Klayman. Thank you for hearing House Bill 58. As was mentioned, House Bill 58 puts into Alaska statute language that is consistent with the standards set in the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee. It also requires health insurance providers to, at the request of the consumer, provide coverage for a 12-month supply of contraceptives at one time, including over-the-counter emergency contraception that was obtained without a prescription, and provide reimbursement to a healthcare provider or dispensing entity. This is laid out in Section 1. Section 1 also gives healthcare insurers the ability to enact reasonable cost containment measures. Cost containment is defined as incentivizing the use of generic or lower cost medications, The inclusion of this language gives insurers the ability to steer towards generics as a cost containment strategy. This was a provision that was discussed with the Department of Administration in past versions of the bill that we included. However, subsection F states, if the covered therapeutically equivalent version of a prescription contraceptive is not available or is considered medically inadvisable by the healthcare provider of the insured, a healthcare insurer shall provide coverage with without cost sharing for an alternative therapeutically equivalent version of the prescription contraceptive. The inclusion of this establishes that even though insurers will be allowed to steer toward generics, if a particular generic or brand is determined medically inappropriate, then the insurer must accommodate the insured. Finally, subsection H includes a religious exemption. So health plans sponsored by certain exempt religious employers are not subject to the requirements of section 1. Section 2 amends AS 2910-200 by adding a provision applying to home rule municipalities. Section 3 amends AS 2920 by adding a new section clarifying that municipal healthcare insurance plans that are self-insured are subject to the requirements laid out in Section 1. Section 4 amends AS 3930090A, which relates to policies of group insurance covering state employees, by adding a new subsection to capture group health insurance policies covering employees of a participating governmental unit. Section 5 amends AS 3930091, which relates to self-insurance and excess loss insurance, by adding language to capture a self-insured group medical plan covering active state employees. So to sum up, Section 4 and 5 clarify that the requirements of Section 1 apply to active state employees. Section 6 directs the Department of Health and Social Services to cover the 12-month supply of prescription contraceptives. HESS must also provide coverage for over-the-counter emergency contraception that was obtained without a prescription. Section 7 directs the Department of Health and Social Services to amend and submit for federal approval a state plan for medical assistance coverage consistent with Section 6. Section 8 is a conditional effect of Section 6 of the bill, and Section 9 pertains to effective dates.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions from members of the committee for the bill sponsor or staff? All right. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you very much, Representative Klayman, for bringing this. So the insurance companies are being required to pay 12 months of contraceptive. And if a person is, and just can understand this flow of question here, is a person is under the insurance, and then 2 months later they're no longer under that insurance, that they could be having their contraceptives for the 12 months because they acquired that. Does that exist with other medications where insurance company is obligated to pay into the future when they're not even covering such a person in their kind of front loading for them?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, whether it's a 3 month or a 12 month, that scenario could arise, and I would assume does arise with some frequency, in which somebody's on a health plan and then after they get the prescription filled, whether it's 2 weeks later or 2 months later or 6 months later, depending on the length of the prescription, they would still have their prescription and continue to take the medication. But that's actually going to also the reverse scenario would apply too. So employee has a 12-month birth in a simple scenario, an employee has a 12-month supply of birth control. They've taken the first 6 months, they change jobs, they start with the new employer. Well, the new employer's insurance wouldn't have to pay for the first 6 months of coverage because that was paid by the other. And so then in the scheme of things, it basically works out the same. Yes, there will be some changes, but to the extent an employer picks up a tab, statistically, they're also likely to have savings from somebody that comes to work for them with an existing prescription.
You follow up?
Yeah, follow up. I'm just wondering, as I see people getting the prescription, and then they may, like you said, their insurance runs out, they have that script for a time, it's a challenge for them, whatever, the transition. But what are you hearing from the insurance industry in that aspect of being so far ahead? And I like the idea, but what are you hearing from them?
We haven't, in our prior discussions, because this isn't the first time we've had this bill, mm-hmm. in our prior discussions, there were no concerns raised by the insurance industry that I think the scenario I described where it works out on both sides of the equation, that they didn't have any concerns with that. You could, Ms. Winghire is here, she might be able to provide more detail if you'd like.
Ms. Winghire?
Can we do a brief at ease real quick?
Brief at ease. All right. Director Winghire, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lori Winghire, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. Through the Chair, could we have the question repeated, please?
Representative McCarty.
Okay, through the Chair. Thank you. So the question is, what are you hearing from the insurance industry in that if they are paying for someone's medication for 12 months and maybe the beneficiary of the insurance only has the coverage with that insurance for 2 months and then they no longer have that. Are you hearing a rebuttal from the insurance companies that they're like, well, it seems like we're really put out in advance and we're not sure if they're going to stay, the beneficiary is going to stay with that program or that company?
Through the Chair, Representative McCarty, I mean, that's a valid point. The insurance companies have not commented on it. They are well aware that this bill is out there, but there has not been any, they have not contacted me, and to the best of my knowledge, they have not contacted the sponsor on that concern.
And this is actually, if I remember correctly, this is the third time that the sponsor has had this particular bill. I've heard it a few times, a few different ways, and it's my understanding that there are other medications that people often will get for longer periods of time. So this is not a new, it's not a novel idea, and that you can, with a pharmacy benefit manager, get 3 months of, you know, other kinds of medication that you have taken for a long period of time, right? So this might happen in other areas as well. I think that was part of your original question, Representative McCarty.
Madam Chair, that is a very good point. We often, most prescriptions are let on a 90-day, if not a 6-month supply that they're prescribed, mm-hmm. and through the pandemic, we were encouraging pharmacists to refill at a longer length to keep people from having to go to the pharmacy or to worry that your drugs would be available when needed.
All right, I'll give you one more follow-up, and then we've got Representatives Nelson, Fields, and Snyder in queue.
So, through the Chair, the follow-up is, and I like this, but I'm wondering the precedent setting of this, so we have some medications that are very expensive, and now they're going to say, well, I should be able to use that for a long stretch for that medication as well.
Through the Chair, Representative McCarty, and it's just the way insurance plans operate. They usually change either on a fiscal year or the calendar year. So if I go to the doctor in November because I've paid my deductible and before I get a new one, I want to get a physical, and they prescribe a year of medications or 6 months, I get the first 3 months filled. In January 1, I've got a new plan, got a new insurer. So I've got 2 months of a plan that the old guy paid for, and I won't ask the new insurer to pay for anything to March. So it's quite common to see that. And as Representative Klayman alluded to, it works both ways because the new one's not paying, the old one did, and there's no perfect way to do it because insurance change. The employers put them out for bid and they change.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Next up is Representative Nelson. Is your question for Ms. Winghire or for the bill sponsor?
Probably for the bill sponsor.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Winghire. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the Chair to Representative Klayman, I see in one of the fiscal notes, and I touched on it a little bit earlier in previous hearings of this bill. Some of the testimony that was heard was discussion of out in rural communities, how difficult it is to receive contraceptives, and it's almost like having to drive back and forth to a place that they can fill it. And I look at this fiscal note for the AlaskaCare employee medical plan, where It is also accessible at either retail locations or mail order. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that, or the reason why that wasn't extended onto this plan, or kind of just some history behind that.
Can you repeat the question? I needed to go back. I'm sorry, I needed to look at the
phone. No worries. I'm just wondering, off the testimony we heard, and this current extension with Alaska Care Medical Employee Plans, why wasn't the mail order section that's already being extended to some people included onto this bill? There's a reason behind that, or
through the chair, it's my general understanding of the mail order plans that those are all voluntary. The insurers love the mail order plans because they actually dispense the prescription for less, and typically the mail order prescriptions are for longer, mm-hmm. but they're never mandatory, and so that you've never got plans that say we won't let you go to your local pharmacy. And I think the reason we're not mandating the mail order plans, they would still be optional plans that are offered by the health insurer because those usually save them money. And this bill would not prevent that.
Okay.
Follow up?
I'm just looking at, and some of the testimony we heard last time and looking at your sponsor statement, the struggle of receiving it, contraceptives, and I just feel like mail order would be a little bit better, and maybe me and you can have a conversation about this after the fact.
Through the chair, I've always been a supporter of the mail order prescriptions. I also recognize that a lot of consumers very much want the consultation with the pharmacist, and that in-person consultation is, again, I never want to stand in the way of consumer choice, but I have no problem as a conceptual matter to encourage more use of mail order pharmacy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Fields.
I was just going to say in partial answer to Representative McCarty's question that I had asked Aetna, and Aetna's representative said they were neutral on the bill.
I assure you that the insurance industry is well represented in the with lobbyists, and if they were concerned, they would let us know immediately. All right, next up we've got Representative Snyder and then Representative Kaufman.
Just following on Co-Chair Fields' comments in response to Representative McCarty, I think for additional context is to also think that we've heard earlier that it would result in fewer visits to the doctor's office, which then can be a balancing in terms of the cost to the insurance company. And for additional context, I was curious what other places permitted long-term prescriptions. And there are several states that do prescription durations, not just for contraceptives, at 12 months, and in fact, if you look at Idaho, Illinois, Iowa, Maine, South Carolina, and Wyoming, they range between 15 and 24 months, just for context.
And if I remember earlier, there's a 30% drop in pregnancy, which pregnancy is very expensive for insurers, so I think that reducing unintended pregnancy, 50% of all pregnancies in the United States as well as in Alaska are unintended, so reducing unintended pregnancy will actually save insurance companies money. All right, next up we've got Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair for the bill sponsor, I'm just trying to be sure I understand line, starting on line 11, with reference to the preceding paragraph on page 1, where it's referring to item B, emergency contraception, including over-the-counter emergency contraception. So that I assume that is referring to what's commonly known as the morning after pill. And I'm just wondering, so as I read this, this would prevent insurance from being issued in the state of Alaska that would that would not include that by that clause.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, for the record, this is Lizzie Kubitz, staff to Representative Klayman. This was actually an addition that was made in the previous committee, and the conversation that was had during that committee was a scenario where someone needs emergency contraception, they don't have an immediate prescription but they can get it over the counter and then they can reimburse their insurer later on. I think that was the intent of the amendment and the language that you see.
Do you follow?
Yes. I guess what I'm trying to picture, there are those that are conscientious objectors to that, you know, to the process and even by that method. And I'm just wondering if they would be able to get insurance that they felt philosophically aligned with if this were to pass.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I think as I went through this sectional, I did touch on a religious exemption in this bill. So employers that do object to covering contraception have the option to pick a plan that wouldn't, and I think that's well addressed within the bill.
Follow up. I guess I'm just through the chair. I'm just wondering if one would exist. I'm just having to think about this a little bit as presented here. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I think Ms. Winghart can address the availability of insurance for employers that want insurance plans that don't include contraceptive coverage. The contraceptive coverage wouldn't just be the part on page one as to emergency contraception, but when they exclude the coverage, it's to all contraception. But Ms. Winghart can probably address the availability of plans.
Ms. Winghart.
Thank you.
Through the chair, once again, this is Lori Winghire, the director of the Division of Insurance. Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, this was a lengthy discussion in the previous committee, and I learned a little bit myself, that we knew that an employer can ask, as an individual can, to not have the coverage in their plan. They don't have to offer it to their employees.
And Ms. Winghire, you might want to speak into the microphone for the secretary. Thank you.
Too far away.
All right.
And frankly, it doesn't have to be really because of a religious exemption. There's Supreme Court ruled a year ago, 2020, that an individual could purchase a policy that did not provide for contraception or abortion if it was against their belief.
Follow up. And that would be by the individual, so not by the. So that would enable an individual within a plan to.
You're the chair, Representative Kaufman. If you were the employer, you would elect for your group, all your employees. If I'm buying as an individual, just me, myself, then I'm just choosing for me. So an employer choosing, much like the Hobby Lobby case and others, would be choosing for the entire corporation or business, if you would, and all employees.
Thank you.
All right. Are there additional questions for the bill's sponsor or Ms. Kubitz? All right. Thank you very much. Looks like we've tapped out our questions and curiosity today. All right. One last one. Representative Kaufman, we still have another bill to do.
And great. More bills. Thank you.
We do a lot of bills in this committee, don't we?
And I was just wondering, on page two, and that's as far as I got, but I've got my highlighter out, and I'll dig deeper. Page two, at the very bottom, starting around 28, in this subsection, cost containment means incentivizing the use of generic or lower-cost medications or the use of healthcare providers or pharmacies that offer service prescription at lower. Could that language be tight enough to avoid other opportunities for cost containment? Just wondering if it's overly specific. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, this is Lizzie Kubitz, staff to Representative Klayman. So the inclusion of that language that you mentioned was a bit of a compromise. We were in discussions with the Department of Administration back in 2017 and 2018 about that language, and wanting to have the option to steer towards generics and use providers and pharmacies that they cover and negotiate lower rates. And that's the language that we landed on. I would have to ask DOA for clarification any further.
Follow up? Yeah, thank you. Just as written, it looks like it's really saying, here's what cost containment means. And I'm afraid that may leave other, you know, beneficial opportunities out. Thank you.
I think that this provision is really designed just specifically to relate to contraception, and the issue is that they wanted to be able to have cost containment measures but not interfere in the doctor-patient relationship. There are times when the, you know, generic medication hasn't been effective for whatever the therapeutic reason for the medication is. For example, there are other things that contraception is used for beyond preventing pregnancy. It's sometimes used to treat endometriosis, to handle, severe cramping, other kinds of acne, sometimes other kinds of things. And if the medication, the generic medication, isn't meeting the therapeutic need, they wanted to preserve the doctor or the provider's ability to prescribe a name brand in the event that was actually the most effective medication. Does that help?
Perhaps. I'll still have to keep staring at it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I just thought I would give you a little context for that, having been a consumer of contraception for most of my adult life. So, all right, very familiar with this. All right, any other questions? All right, thank you very much, Representative Clayman and Ms. Kubitz. We appreciate your time today. All right, next up, we're going to go to our third hearing for HB 44 related to public accountants. In addition to Representative Thompson, we also have available for questions Thomas Neal, chair of the American Institute of CPAs Uniform Accountancy Act Committee, Karen Tarver, my apologies, Alaska Society of CPAs Legislative Committee, Leslie Schmitz, chair of the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy, Sarah Chambers, director of the Division of Corporations Business and Professional Licensing, and Corey Hondalero, executive administrator for the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy. Representative Thompson, welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz and Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm very pleased to be back here again. I hope we can get this bill out today. In addition to the testifiers, you should have
speaking into the microphone, Representative Thompson.
Oh, I'm Steve Thompson from House District 2 in Fairbanks.
Thank you.
I apologize. You should also have a letter from Sarah Chambers, the Division Director on Licensing. And we had a lot of questions our last hearing, and these people are the ones that can answer those questions, and they've also have some testimony, and I will turn it over to them.
All right. And Co-Chair Fields?
It looks like Ms. Tarver may have dropped offline, but I was just going to mention that I did call her after the previous hearing to get additional information, because I did have questions, and Ms. Tarver explained to me that actually this bill increases oversight of CPAs who are based outside of the state, who are operating in the state. So I think with that clarification, that sort of address my concerns, and I'm comfortable moving the bill.
All right. Was there somebody you wanted to do invited testimony, Representative Thompson?
They're all here to answer questions,
okay.
And if you want to go forward, go ahead.
All right. Fantastic. Did you have a question, Representative McCarty?
Through the chair, actually hearing from Representative Fields, that there's similar concerns that I have, and that there's a equality of the process. So if that's the case, and that's what's being told, I'm very comfortable with this as well.
All right. I have a couple of questions on this bill. I think, we're hearing that the bill will actually increase oversight of non-Alaskan licensed CPAs. All right. It looks like Karen Turner is on Tarver. Thank you. Is on Teams, which is great. Maybe she can turn her video on and we can see her. That would be really lovely. But my understanding is that this bill eliminates the fee for non-resident accountants that would be practicing, non-Alaska licensed accountants that would be practicing in the state of Alaska. How is it that the Department of Commerce would have the resources for enforcement? And I guess I'd go to Director Chambers on that.
Uh,
Ms. Chambers, you might be on mute. I see you're online, but...
Thank you. I was just unmuted.
There we go. All right.
Thank you. For the record, this is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. The as we indicated in our response letter, we are not anticipating a spike in investigations, which is really the wild card potential in any licensing program. Other states have not seen an increase. We have never had a history with the mobility that the board currently enjoys from unlicensed out-of-state practitioners. We have not had any demonstrable investigations, and in fact, eliminating this particular permit would provide a savings in overhead because we would not be expending the resources to go through the sort of the front-end licensing processes, audit processes, and so forth. So there is a little bit of a potential for savings, and we have no indication that there would really be an increase in expenses.
All right, thank you. So currently there's a for out-of-state partnerships, corporations, or limited liability companies, there's a $300 application fee and a $900 permit fee. Is that going to continue on under this bill?
Through the chair, or to the chair, Representative Sponholz, that might, the specifics about the licensing program and numbers of licensees might be better answered by the Executive Administrator, Corey Hondalero.
Ms. Hondalero? You heard the question?
Can you hear me?
Yep, sure can.
Okay, this is Corey Hondalero, the Executive Administrator for the State Board of Accountancy, and I work for the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. So to answer your question, out-of-state mobility eliminates that process. So no, those fees would not be incoming anymore. As the director mentioned, this is not a large number. There are currently 98 out-of-state permits active, and those have an expiration date of 12/31/21. And I would say that number that we've registered over the years has stayed fairly consistent. Again, we wouldn't anticipate a large number incoming. If there's questions about the oversight, I think that Karen Burritarver would be a good person to address those.
Okay, I'll ask Ms. Harber about the oversight, but before we do that, my quick back of the envelope math here is that reducing the out-of-state company fee, if there's 98 annual permit payers, could result in a loss of $88,000 in revenue. Does that sound accurate to you, Ms. Hondalero?
That sounds correct. So with a renewal, you don't have that initial application fee, so the renewal fee is the $900 portion of that.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting that extra part when they apply for that initial permitting, but I would generally say that your math sounds accurate.
All right. Ms. Tarver, you want to talk about enforcement and oversight?
Sure, for the record, I'm Karen Tarver. I'm a CPA here in Juneau with LG Rayfield. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
Okay. I had a little bit of feedback, so I wanted to make sure. So is there a specific question that I can address?
Representative Fields?
Ms. Tarver, maybe you could walk me through, or walk us through, like you walked me through, how this provides greater oversight over activities of firms that are based outside of Alaska. Activities that we're aware of today versus activities that would be, I guess, policed, so to say, if this bill were to pass.
Sure, thank you. And so through the chair, I'll answer that question. Currently, what you don't see in the bill in its entirety is the information that's being taken out, and that is in section 44 of the bill, it lists different statute sections, and so 08, 04, 421 is currently the out-of-state permits and exemption section, and that is being deleted in its entirety. And the way that the current statute reads is that it's only firms that are providing designated services And designated services is defined as test functions specifically performed under what's called standards of accounting, excuse me, statements of auditing standards. So it really is just audits. And so basically there's an exemption that it for firms from out of state that are coming in and providing services to Alaskans businesses. If they're not providing audit services, there's an exemption and they didn't need an out-of-state permit. And so the new statute or the proposed statute changes basically expand that to include all attest services. So attest services are defined in section, excuse me, I'm finding it real quick. But the attest services are defined by statute as well, and they are in section 37, page 17 of the House Bill 44, and they include services, the audit services, which did require the out-of-state permit, but they also include a review of financial statements, examination of prospective financial statements, other engagements done in accordance with Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, and any other exemption or examinations that follow the standards of attestation engagements as published by the AICPA. And so what this, what I had shared with Mr. Fields was that we're actually giving the board more oversight in that right now that permit is only has to be applied for and granted to firms providing audit services. By the new statute basically lets firms know that if you're providing anything, it's called practice of public accounting, and again it's defined by statute, then you're accepting basically Alaska's statutes and regulations if you come into our state and provide those services, including the whole attest function, basically. And so that's why it's expanding the board's enforcement capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, thank you. That was very helpful. All right, I'm going to direct my question back to Sarah Chambers. I guess my concern is that we about reducing the out-of-state fees for non-licensed accountants that are practicing in the state of Alaska. It looks like we're going to reduce revenue to your department by $88,000. And you know, we heard earlier in the year that you were under-resourced in a lot of different areas, and I'm just worried about, you know, further reducing resources to the department when you're already stretched fairly thin. Do you want to address that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the recognition of the dynamic. Again, this is Sarah Chambers with the Department of Commerce. The way that our finances, our division finances work are that licensees for a particular program pay into that program. And so revenue from any type of CPA, in this case out-of-state permits, is not revenue that can be utilized for any other program or purpose. And the program right now, the CPA program has, excuse me, they have several $100,000 in surplus. And that again is unique to this program. It is not, it isn't funding that we can use to help the medical board process licenses, for example. So this program, because they have a surplus, we are not increasing their fees. We're trying to pay down that surplus because we're called by state law to try to have our revenues and our expenses balance out. So the board, in their support of this legislation, has looked at the fee analysis and looked at the proposal for what the cost of the program would be with that reduction in revenue. And the board is satisfied, and we are satisfied, that the program will continue to have a surplus even without raising any other fees for the next proposed 4 to 6 years. And by then we'll have an opportunity to see if mobility in Alaska is working the same way that it is working in other states. Again, all of our costs are paid by our licensees. And so in reducing fees in one area, the board, in my understanding and meeting with the board and talking for the board, I don't want to speak totally for them, but that they understand that the trade-off and the loss of this revenue stream is counterbalanced by the ability for Alaska CPAs to enjoy greater mobility in other states. So there is a efficiency and a benefit to our private citizens and our licensees through doing this. So that may be more information than what you actually requested, but the bottom line is that this board has a very healthy bottom line and is not concerned about the reduction in fees, which can only be used to support the CPA program.
All right, thank you. Ms. Schmitz, Leslie Schmitz, who's chair of the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy, would you like to address this? I think the question that came up in a previous committee hearing on this bill was a concern that Alaska license holders would potentially be paying to oversee sort of enforcement of non-Alaskan non-Alaskan accountants practicing in Alaska.
This is Leslie Schmitz. Currently, I'm the current board chairman for the Board of Public Accountancy, and I do agree with Ms. Chambers' assessment that the trade-off in fees is worth the expansion of the mobility for the Alaska CPAs. And in addition, the mobility issue, as Ms. Tarver indicated, would actually give the board more oversight on more services that out-of-state CPAs are providing in the state to Alaska clients. And Sarah, Ms. Chambers is correct. We do, we're CPAs, right? We monitor our budget every meeting that we have. We're always in conversation with the division in regards to what our numbers are. And we do, the division is very graceful in letting us have some input on where we think our fees to the CPA, the Alaska CPAs, should be going. So I think overall this is a win-win for Alaska licensees, and yes, we're going to take a reduction in our budget, but I think we're in a really healthy position right now.
Thank you. And Ms. Schmitz, did you look at other small states and how this worked in other small states? I think we heard from somebody in Washington at the last hearing we had on this topic, and I think economically Alaska is very different than Washington State. I used to live in Seattle when I was going to undergrad, and it's a big, it's a big community with big firms, and I can imagine, accountants in Seattle working in, all throughout the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. Have we seen how this works in a state that maybe is much smaller economically, like a North Dakota or an Idaho?
Chair Sponholz, I believe that Tom Neal, who is the chair of the UAA committee for the AICP, I believe he's online, and he actually, I think, has information on how the mobility issue has impacted other states.
All right, Mr. Neal.
I'd like to defer to him if I could.
Sure. Mr. Neal?
Good afternoon, Chair Sponholz and the committee. I'd be happy to see if I can tackle this question for you. I specifically addressed this question.
You need to introduce Mr. Neal, can you introduce yourself for the record before you proceed with your testimony?
Sorry about that.
No problem.
My name is Thomas Neal, CPA, and I'm chair of the Uniform Accountancy Act Committee of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants.
And where are you based?
I'm based out of Seattle, Washington.
Okay.
So, I got a little bit of a heads up that this was a question that might be posed, and so one of the things I did is I checked with the AICPA staff to see if they had heard of any feedback or complaints relative to this specific issue, and I heard none. So I backtracked through Jennifer Skiba, who's the deputy director of the Washington State Board of Accountancy staff. And what I asked Jennifer was what she is hearing from the executive directors around the country. And it's always important to note that each board of accountancy operates on a complaint-based process. So when we're thinking about out-of-state firms coming into any state and potentially doing a bad thing in that state, unless a complaint is filed, there would be no additional investigatory costs or costs that might be incurred by that state's board. What I did hear from Jennifer and from feedback from other boards of accountancy, both small and large, is that to a large degree there have been very few, if any, complaints about out-of-state practices practicing inside states where mobility is taking place. And again, there's no necessarily statistical data because from what I'm hearing, it's just not happening. So firms, for the most part, I think, are trying to do what they do well. And if a complaint does come in, it can be addressed. But to my knowledge, even the small states have not seen this happen.
All right. Thank you. Representative McCarty has a question?
No.
No? No question. All right. Anybody else? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony and taking on our questions today. And Representative Thompson for joining us again. Do we have a motion?
Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 44, Work Order 32-LS0302/I from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? All right, seeing none, bill moves from committee. That wraps up our business this afternoon. Thanks to everybody for joining us. Our next committee meeting will be Friday, March 14th at 8 a.m. in Gruenberg, Room 120. We'll have introductory hearings for SB 12, Senator Kawasaki's bill relating to temporary courtesy licenses for military spouses, HB 204 for our own Representative Kaufman's bill relating to the presumption of compensability from certain cancers in firefighters, and HB 91, Representative Wohl's bill exempting veterinarians from the PDMP. Thanks again to Leah Fraser, our secretary, and LIO moderator, Alex Vanizek. This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 5:03 p.m. Please stay and sign the paperwork, committee members.